The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, I think it's important to make clear at the very outset of this discussion that recognizing and appreciating the degree of gross inequality that exists in capitalist society, that is inequality that is a necessary feature of not only the exploitation that the system breeds, but also the oppression that the system breeds, is much more important than the term you use to describe it. That is, whether you call it privilege, benefits, or advantages, the only way that we can hope to build a movement that fights oppression in all of its forms and also includes all of the oppressed people within that movement is not by minimizing the degree of oppression that exists, but by recognizing the many manifestations of oppression, no matter which oppressed group you are discussing. So right from the outset, I want to make that absolutely clear. It's also the case that a solid proportion of people, especially young people, who have become radicalized in recent years, have done so precisely because of their recognition and opposition to oppression, be it against racism, sexism, LGBT oppression, disability oppression, or any number of other forms of oppression that exist today. This makes sense. On the one hand, we have seen a dramatic growth in class inequality, which has become even more exacerbated since 2008, and this has led to a sharp rise in class consciousness. Most recently, of course, demonstrated during the Occupy movement in 2011. But this class consciousness is mostly limited to anger at class and social inequality, without any obvious connection to any strategy in particular, and also, in this case, a working class strategy to transforming society. Now, this is completely understandable, since anyone who became politically aware after the mid-1970s, early 80s, which how many of you were even born then, will have had little to no chance to experience firsthand the kind of solidarity that exists when you're on an open-ended strike on the picket line with workers of all different genders, you know, races and whatnot, standing shoulder to shoulder and fighting against the police and the company, and so on. So while it's very obvious to everyone becoming radicalized today the misery that's caused by the system, it's not the potential power to transform the system, and particularly for the working class to transform the system, is not at all obvious today. So recent generations of young radicals often got their first introduction to the issue of combating oppression through reading the very influential essay by Peggy McIntosh that was written in 1989 called White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. Now, I think the best thing about this essay is that it forces white readers to appreciate the many manifestations of racism in daily life. I mean, there's no question that it lays it all out, you know, from walking down the street to entering a store and being followed by the security and so on. Very, very important stuff. But the essay itself focuses primarily on raising individual awareness about one's individual privilege rather than putting forward any particular strategy for ending racism. I also find that McIntosh's essay tends to conflate the meaning of white, which I think is often the case, with white middle class, assuming that the majority of whites are middle class, which is actually factually incorrect, and therefore doesn't integrate a class analysis. However, I think for its intended purposes, this essay really does raise awareness. It does primarily good, and it's worth noting that it certainly doesn't call for privilege checking as a strategy for social change, except perhaps quietly, you know, when you're looking in the mirror you know, questioning whether you have privilege. That's a whole different phenomenon than what we have today. That the strategy we have today arrived much later on. I quickly want to focus some time on explaining how the political climate has changed dramatically in the last four decades, and how that the political climate has markedly affected strategies for social change within the broader radical left, because it wasn't always this way. It's well known that during the late 60s and early 70s, there was a period of mass social upheaval and mass radicalization around the globe. In the United States, the civil rights movement gave rise to the Black Power movement. The National Liberation Front in Vietnam radicalized the anti-war movement and dealt a severe blow to U.S. imperialism through its grassroots national liberation struggle from below. The women's liberation movement, partly inspired by the Black liberation movement, used mass action to raise radical demands. The gay liberation front, which arose, you know, as a result of the Stonewall Rebellion in 69, borrowed its name from the Vietnamese liberation front in a clear identification with that anti-imperialist struggle. So you're talking mass radicalization here. Vietnam vets returned from fighting a pointless war and watching their fellow soldiers be killed by the 58,000 soldiers had been killed in that war. And they came home and found themselves radicalized and then going and taking factory jobs and so on, and transferring that radicalism into workplace struggle. So this was a time when there was a massive rise in US working class strikes and struggles, including a series of wildcat strikes against the wishes of the union leadership. There was also rank and file movements like the Miners for Democracy, the Teamsters for a Decent Contract, a whole number of other rank and file working class movements, which together showed in practice how the working class can be the agent of revolution. You could see it. It was palpable at that time. You can see how all these movements built upon each other to compose that mass radicalization. By the early 1970s, many radicals believed, and not unreasonably, that revolution would soon be on the agenda. In that context of mass struggle, mass radicalization, many young activists turned to Marxism as a revolutionary theory and formed a variety of revolutionary organizations in that period. Now, few could have expected at the start of the 1970s that by the mid-1970s, the US corporate class would regroup itself and launch what we call an employer's offensive that became official with the election of Ronald Reagan way back in 1980 that has lasted until today. Now it's known as neoliberalism. That's our shorthand term for it. Now, whereas in the early 70s, many radicals believed that revolution was going to be on the agenda, by the end of the decade, the political trajectory was moving in the opposite direction pretty rapidly. The neoliberal era transformed the balance of class and social forces decisively in favor of capital on a global scale, returning class inequality to what it had been back in the Gilded Age. This onslaught has been aimed at primarily at lowering working class living standards and busting working class organizations, unions in particular, but it has also been accompanied by vitriolic attacks on all the gains of the 1960s era movements, along with open racism, misogyny, homophobia, and so on in the political mainstream. Most 1980s radical activists, by the 80s, were forced to absorb this dramatic political and social transformation. And after the initial shock, and as one who was around then, let me tell you, there was a lot of initial shock and denial, disbelief, eight stages of grief, yeah. But a sense of pessimism, a cloud of pessimism descended on most of the left, in which the left as a whole, the majority of the left, lost confidence that the revolution that seemed so possible just a decade earlier would never take place. I mean, it went from, you know, it's going to happen any time, to it's never going to happen. Now, most radical social theorists adjusted to the neoliberal reality by turning away from what is still called structural analyses, and Marxism in particular, which we look at this, to make it simple in plain language, which it rarely is. So, you know, it took me a lot. This may sound simple, but it hasn't been simple getting here. Marxism locates exploitation in capitalism, locates the source of oppression in capitalism. That is a structural analysis. And, you know, Marxism also relies on an analysis of objective material realities. All of this was dismissed out of hand as, you know, and these are negative comments, just in case it wasn't obvious, essentialist, reductionist, and widely derided by postmodern theorists as truths, totalities, and universalities, in the name of creating a new radical politics of anti-essentialism. So I hope that was somewhat clear. Like I said, it took me a long time to translate this. Okay. The conception of the systemic roots of injustice and the possibility of achieving systemic change were replaced by a focus on subjective, individual, and cultural relations as the new centers of struggle, not class struggle, cultural and language struggle, and so on, and which included reclaiming or reappropriating oppressive language as a tool to combat oppression. Now, in this process, postmodernism and the accompanying, or within it, post-structural and post-Marxist theories achieved dominance by the 1980s, overriding dominance. Now, two of post-Marxism's key therapists, yeah. I could use one after reading all this stuff. But Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe argue this explicitly, and I just want to quote them because it's actually pretty jarring how explicit this was. They argued in 1985, "There are not, for example, necessary links between anti-sexism and anti-capitalism." Combating sexism or combating oppression, and they write, requires the autonomization of the spheres of struggle, i.e., each sphere of struggle has no relationship to any other sphere of struggle. And maybe what's most remarkable is that Laclau and Mouffe actually envision all struggles is not only free-floating and autonomous with no relationship to each other, but these struggles do not even need to involve more than two people. So, yeah, they stated this explicitly. Gabriella. Many of these forms of resistance are made manifest not in the form of collective struggles, but through an increasingly armed individualism. Now, in this way, interpersonal relationships can be key sites of struggle based on subjective perceptions of which the individual is in a position of, one is in the position of quote-unquote dominance, this is their words, and the other one is in a position of quote-unquote subordination in any particular situation. That could change 5 minutes from now because the other individual may become dominant. I mean, it's all very, very subjective and personal. Now, this emphasis on individualism has led some post-structuralists to object to the use of broad so-called binary, well, there is a thing called binary, but in this context, binary categories such as women and black women. Now, they've done this over the objection of a number of leading black feminists, including Kimberlé Crenshaw, who coined the term intersectionality in 1989. Crenshaw took issue with this, with not being allowed to use such an essentialist term as black women. And this is what she said. She said this version of anti-essentialism embodying what might be called the vulgarized social construction thesis, which is that since all categories are socially constructed, there is no such thing as, say, blacks or women, and thus it makes little sense to continue reproducing these categories by organizing around them. But then she goes on to say, at this point in history, a strong case can be made that the most critical resistance strategy for disempowered groups is to occupy and defend a politics of social location rather than to vacate and destroy it, i.e. black women need to organize as black women in order to challenge racism. Now, just as neoliberalism survived all this time, the economic meltdown, who knew? I honestly did not believe we'd still be in such a, you know, consistent neoliberal era. But the accompanying postmodernist outlook has also lasted commensurate with neoliberalism thus far. Now, to be sure, there are signs of resurgence toward Marxism, a new generation of radicals and radical academics that are attracted to Marxism. You know, and this is not like me just dropping it out of the sky. Look at how many people are at this socialism conference. But the pessimism that's inherent to postmodernism prevails on the broad left. Now, today's generation of radicals, again, this makes sense. What has today's young generation experienced but a lifetime of a major decline in living standards, defeats, setbacks, and very, very few victories in between? There has never been such an extended period in U.S. history of working class retreat and defeat, now going on 40 years. Now, while we should not expect this to be a permanent state of affairs, this prevailing sense of pessimism is almost like a cloud that still hangs over the left and helps to maintain the influence of common assumptions of postmodernist theory. Even among activists who have no idea what post-structuralism or postmodernism stand for or how privilege checking originated as a strategy for social change from this pessimistic outlook. Why does any of this history matter for a discussion about the effectiveness of privilege checking? Because every strategy for social change is rooted in a political worldview. If you don't actually think that revolution is possible or can envision how such a revolution could realistically come about, then it makes perfect sense to focus our political energies on making the best of this rotten world that we can in the here and now. Within the postmodernist, post-structuralist worldview, an overriding emphasis is placed on the subjective, individual, interpersonal, and cultural relations as centers of struggle, including reclaiming or appropriating oppressive language. Now, language is far from irrelevant, I want to make that clear. But if we want to change the use of language among the masses of people, we need to build a mass movement that affects mass consciousness. This was certainly the case in the 1960s movements for social justice, which transformed the mass use of language from colored people to black, from girls to women. These were all the result of struggle, of mass-based struggle. This has also been the case with the long-standing movement among queer activists. Initially organizing around the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s, began to struggle militantly around the slogan, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it," way back in the 1980s. Today, the word queer has been transformed from a derogatory term to a positive description in much of society. But if our aim is for the mass transformation of society, which requires building a mass movement, we can't realize it by calling individual people out or privilege checking. Calling out racism, sexism, homophobia, and other reactionary attitudes is obviously a necessary part of fighting oppression in everyday life. And we certainly appreciate it if the offending party apologizes for their transgression. This is true. But this is also a far cry from what is needed to end oppression. In reality, privilege checking does little to challenge the class and social status quo, despite the fact that most activists who engage in privilege checking believe that the status quo needs changing. Now, while there's no doubt that those who take part in privilege checking are well-intentioned, I think that it ends up ultimately replacing politics with morality, which is always subjective. Morality is always a subjective judgment, and therefore backfires in the following ways. It can end up, number one, alienating the very people who could be won to building a movement to end oppression, because they do not all only because they don't already share the current language of the self-identified radical left. The radical left, I'm sure I'm not telling you something you don't already know, but I want to reinforce, the radical left is tiny in the United States. And because of this, it can easily become inward and insular in its outlook, creating an echo chamber instead of reaching outward to win the next layer of people radicalizing in society. If the point is to help the radical left to grow, we are better off not shaming and humiliating people who are well-intentioned but not already acquainted with the currently accepted language within the radical left, which would be an impossibility given the current marginalization of the radical left from the mainstream of society. Instead of shaming people not already acquainted with radical language, we should aim to win them to our hopes of transforming society. Secondly, it's worth noting that the language of the radical left, as tiny as it is, has changed rapidly over the last decade alone, with the most evident being the list of growing sexual identities attached to the LGBTQ label, which originally, by the way, designated a shared experience of oppression among lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgender and queer people at large. The list has now expanded to, LGBTQQIAA, which some campuses have LGBTQIAA centers. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, intersex, ally, and asexual, with additional identities including pansexual, omnisexual, and trisexual, agender, bigender, third gender, and polyamorous, also gaining recognition. Now, we should celebrate this growing list of sexual identities. There's no question about that. But we shouldn't confuse identity with systematic oppression. While expanding sexualities is a welcome development, it also tends to bury the original purpose of LGBT label, which was intended to include trans people as a recognized group of oppressed people, which hadn't been the way it was before, accompanied by demands for gender-neutral campus housing, gender-neutral bathrooms, and gender-neutral language, which have been raised specifically to combat transgender oppression. While those who choose to identify as asexual or ally, for example, should have the right to identify that way, social attitudes and institutional discrimination against these identities is hardly comparable to the enormous degree of oppression faced by trans people. And I think trans oppression gets buried when you have what amounts to a laundry list of identities. Great, have the identities, but don't confuse that with oppression. The practice of privilege checking relies on its own fairly rigid method of mechanical determinism, some of it actually based on biology, assuming that the assertions of a non-privileged person who calls out a privileged person based on a particular comment, misuse of language, or personal demeanor of that conceived of by the privileged person, if a non-privileged person calls someone out, that cannot be challenged. Those who are privileged in a given situation can only offer support and apologies to the non-privileged by checking their privilege and calling out others who are also privileged. Now, this approach places its overriding emphasis on who is making a particular argument or accusation rather than the content of that argument or accusation. In this context, moralism can easily supersede politics and prevent the kind of honest and useful debate that is essential to democratic norms. It's easy to see how this approach can inhibit the free exchange of ideas, including necessary political debates that we have to have that don't necessarily emanate from our personal experience of being oppressed, because we're all committed to transforming society. The rituals of privilege checking can result in mutually destructive moralism. As Native American scholar and activist Andrea Smith argued not very long ago of privilege workshops that she's attended, she said they have a bit of self-help orientation to them. I am so-and-so and I have X privilege. It was never quite clear what the point of these confessions were. It was not as if other participants did not know the confessor in question and had his or her proclaimed privilege. It did not appear that these individual confessions actually led to any political projects to dismantle the structures of domination that enabled their privilege. Rather, the confessions became the political project themselves. The benefits of these confessions seemed to be ephemeral. For the instant the confession took place, those who do not have that privilege in daily life would have a temporary position of power as the hearer of the confession who would grant absolution and forgiveness. The sayer of the confession could then be granted temporary forgiveness for his or her abuses of power and relief from white/male/heterosexual, etc. guilt. Because of the perceived benefits of this ritual, there was generally little critique of the fact that in the end, it primarily served to reinstate the structures of domination that it was supposed to resist. And then she says, those who had little privilege did not, essentially the current social structure conditions us to exercise what privileges we may have. If we want to undermine those privileges, we must change the structures within we live so we can become different people in the process. Back to structuralism. I also just want to add that the characters that are often used in this kind of mechanical determinism assumes, for example, like cis men. They couldn't possibly, you know, they are at all times unoppressed. Cis upper class men. But this does not take into account that, for example, things like rape, child abuse, do not merely occur among the specially oppressed people of the population. Secondly, black cis men, if there's anybody more victimized by the racist approach criminalizing black men in the South and in the North during the era of white supremacy that carries on today, is that they are systematically wrongly accused of raping white women and then going to prison for crimes that they didn't commit. It's a lot more complicated than the hierarchy that's depicted here says. The approach to deciding who is privileged and who is not has increasingly relied upon subjective moral judgments rather than any objective relationship to the capitalist system. So some on the radical left have taken to describing unionized workers as a privileged population who don't deserve the support of the radical left or even low-wage workers, despite the fact that whatever advantages union workers have gained in terms of wages and working conditions have been the result of their own working class struggle against capital, and that these advantages are currently the target for destruction on the neoliberal agenda. I want to give you just one example of this. A new book called The Worker Elite, Notes on the Labor Aristocracy by someone named Brahma, argues that this strategy of unionized workers comprises a quote-unquote parasitic section of the middle class, and that, quote, flattering a falling worker elite with crocodile tears for its lost privileges leads to disaster for proletarian forces. I hope that I don't need to explain to this audience why that approach to privilege is an enormous problem, but it's a product of this approach to privilege in which everything's subjective and nothing is objective. So, okay, we're all entitled to our individual anger, But individual anger is not going to transform the system. Mm-hmm. Only a mass working class movement can do that. So how do we take steps towards that? Marxism is necessary because it provides a framework for understanding the relationship between oppression and exploitation, i.e., oppression as a byproduct of the system of class exploitation, and also identifies the strategy for creating the material and social conditions that will make it possible to end both oppression and exploitation. The working class holds the potential to lead a struggle in the interests of all those who suffer injustice and oppression. This is not because the working class is morally superior, but because both exploitation and oppression are rooted in capitalism. Exploitation is the method by which the ruling class robs workers of surplus value. The various forms of oppression play a primary role in maintaining the rule of a tiny minority over the vast majority. In each case, the enemy is one and the same. As producers of the goods and services that keep capitalism running, workers have the ability to shut down the system through a mass strike. And workers not only have the power to shut down the system, but also to replace it with a socialist society based upon collective ownership of the means of oppression. Although other groups in society certainly suffer oppression, only the working class possesses this objective power. Many people assume that when Marxists talk about building, this is really my last point, that when we Marxists, about building a united working class movement for socialism, that the fight against oppression is automatically, therefore, relegated secondary to the class struggle. In fact, the opposite is true. Mm-hmm. And this has been integral to the revolutionary Marxist tradition since the time of the Russian Revolution, when Russian revolutionary V.I. Lenin said specifically, well, first of all, he called revolutions festivals of the oppressed and exploited, but secondly, he argued explicitly that the fight against oppression has to include a fight against exploitation, has to include a fight against all forms of oppression, no matter what class is affected. He said, working class consciousness cannot be genuine political consciousness unless the workers are trained to respond to all cases of tyranny, oppression, violence, and abuse, no matter what class is affected. Unless they are trained, moreover, to respond from a social democratic point of view and no other. Today, the working class is made up of many races, genders, many different sexualities and gender identities. And there is every reason to believe that working class self-emancipation can champion the fight against all forms of oppression. In this context, it's obvious why oppressed people are in the best position to describe and lead the fight against their own oppression. So, just to summarize my conclusion, while postmodernists tend to emphasize the differences that exist between individuals, Marxists strive to unite all those who face a common enemy into a single movement. If our goal is to build a united working class movement that can fight against every form of oppression, it requires building solidarity. As expressed in the slogan of the labor movement, an injury to one is an injury to all. Such solidarity cannot be built, it can only be built, if we focus on building a common project and a common trust shared by all who are fighting on the same side of the class struggle, and use the necessary patience toward others that can win them to a revolutionary common socialist project. Thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.